Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, April 16th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're going to review the top stories in money and markets, address one great question we got from a subscriber in Ask Catherine, and then we're going to be joined by Dmitry Orlov, who's the author of Reinventing Collapse. He's a software engineer who is now an American citizen, came to this country at a young age, but had the opportunity to go back and forth during Russia during the collapse, and has done some marvelous writing about comparing the conditions in the Soviet Union before collapse, conditions in the United States, and comparing the two situations, and then talking about what we would do here if we had to experience such a collapse. So with that, let me start with money and markets. My theme tonight is let them eat cake. As most Americans are grappling with paying their taxes, today is the day after individual tax day are due. It's a sort of a huge pig going through a snake every year in America, but particularly when the economy is poor and people are feeling the pain. It's always a tense time. And we've seen a series of headlines that are just breathtaking in the gap between the treatment of the wealthiest and most powerful in the American society and those with the least or the least protected. Let me just run through them. I got an email from someone in the network that really struck me, so I put it up today. Usually on the blog when I get something like that, I call it In From the Network. And a very solid financial person noticed this, a private investor who sent me an email saying, two unrelated headlines appeared next to each other on Yahoo today. The first was White House will not prosecute CIA officials for waterboarding. And the second was, not on the menu, pizza workers charged in pranks, Associated Press. If you drill down and look at the pizza worker story, what you discover is that, and let me just read it to you to give you a sense of how ridiculous this is. A gross video posted on YouTube showing a Domino's pizza worker stuffing cheese up his nostril and waving salami under his rear end as he is making sandwiches has led to charges against him and a coworker who recorded him, authorities said Wednesday. Christy Lynn Hammonds, 31, of Taylorsville, and Michael Anthony Seltzer, 32, of Conover, are each charged with distributing prohibited foods. Police Chief Gary LaFon says it is the same North Carolina statute that forbids any tampering with Halloween candy. So the officials who instituted the waterboarding will not be prosecuted, but Domino pizza workers who make YouTube videos with their cheese will be. And so my network member says, do we have our priorities straight? Another headline is Lehman sitting on a stockpile of uranium, which means that we now have the U.S. bankruptcy courts trading in uranium. Even more shocking, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, we had, while Gottschall builds Lehman, $55 million for its next installment of bankruptcy legal work. That bill of $55 million included $200,000 for business meals and approximately $755,000 for 795 hours billed by the firm's bankruptcy star, Harvey Miller, who is billing at a rate of $950 an hour. Now, if you, again, drill down in that article, what you'll see, and this, I just love this one, what you'll see is a quote from a bankruptcy professor, or a bankruptcy law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, David Skeel, who says the fees paid to Weil and other top firms are often worth the results they deliver. Weil did great work in Enron, he said. It started in complete chaos, but at the end, the creditors got a decent recovery. Now, one of the things it doesn't mention is if you look at the board of overseers of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, you have a Weil Gottschall partner who's donated very liberally to the school. So we literally have you know, a lawyer who is using his academic status to justify a billing of $950 an hour. We're literally in a country where now people are going without food and health insurance, you know, in very significant ways as unemployment is rising, without mentioning the serious conflicts of interest. It's interesting. If you go look at the board, what you'll see is that many of the organizations listed have been involved directly or indirectly in the rape of Russia, interestingly enough, because one of the things that happened in the collapse that Dmitry Orlov has written so much about is you had global financial interests really literally take the country down, launder huge amounts of money out, bring it into the United States. So you're sitting and looking at this board of, you know, organizations involved in that, involved in Enron, involved in the missing money, not to mention someone from KKR. If, for those of you who've read my Dylan Reed story, you know that KKR was the owner of RJR Nabisco when the European Union brought its amazing lawsuit alleging significant global money laundering with drug cartels around the world. So you get a sense when you drill down into this story. Another example of something I've said many, many times, which is the universities and foundations that have endowments have become shills for sort of systemized criminality, and we're really seeing the top brands in our country used to justify this let-them-eat-cake attitude. At the same time this is happening, the fourth quarter data came out on for the U.S. Fed funds data, and it indicated that there had been another $5.1 trillion decline in household net worth. That's a 9% decline since the peak in the second quarter of 2007. Household wealth is down almost $13 trillion, with households having lost an estimated additional $2 trillion in the first quarter of 2009. And what's interesting is the reports that I'm getting from the network over the last week since we talked last indicate very serious pain. I had an entrepreneur send me a message saying, I've had three friends this week ask me for help to give them loans to pay back taxes. What you're hearing are reports throughout, and it's not, you know, throughout the middle class and people who used to think of themselves as fairly well off, but we're seeing as the unemployment grows, people eat through the unemployment benefits and their savings. And as that happens, again, this summer I think is going to be a very difficult time. I wanted to focus your attention on one posting I put up on the blog on Sundays called Is Your Pie Legal? And I linked to an article from the Wall Street Journal about a church outside of Pittsburgh who had state inspectors inspecting their kitchen at the same time they were preparing for one of their annual fish fries. And the state inspectors realized that a variety of different pies made by the ladies in the congregation had not been cooked in inspected kitchens and therefore couldn't be part of the fish fry. And so the coconut cream pie and a few other pies were basically evicted from St. Celia's fish fry. Now, I mention this because, you know, when it goes back to the Domino Pizza story, when you have a time like this, what you see is more and more pressure as the political anger rises about the corruption. You have more and more pressure on the enforcement bureaucracies to enforce. The challenge that they have is there's tremendous pressure on them not to enforce against the politically powerful and certainly those who can hire law firms like Weil, Gotshaw, et cetera. And so what happens is they redouble their efforts on those who don't have political clout. And oftentimes that can involve things that seem minor, like, you know, Mrs. So-and-so's coconut cream pie. But it can also target innocent people. You know, I was part of, I was financial advisor to an agency that the inspector general literally had a racketeering practice of making money by coming and doing an audit and basically agreeing, you know, that they'd go away for something less than it would cost you to be audited and irritated by them. So, and in that vein, I put up a video from a Senator Nancy Schaefer, incredible video from a state senator from Georgia talking about how child service agencies literally make money. They get paid per child when they move a child out of a household and get them adopted by a different household. And literally her efforts to stop social service agencies from coming in and taking away children in households that literally shouldn't have been moved and putting them into new households. And it's a pretty frightening video, and not unlike the story I tell in the Dylan Reed story about rounding up innocent kids and throwing them in jail because the stocks, the new prison stocks, are trading on a per-basis. And the more they fill up the jails, the more money everybody makes, including the politicians who are getting campaign contributions from them. And that story at one point seems sort of out there, but yet we've now found stories in Pennsylvania. I keep getting copies of the judge who literally got kickbacks for every kid that they arranged to send to the juvenile detention center, and you know they got a sort of a per kid kickback, and sure enough they were sending kids to prison for ludicrous, or to juvenile detention for ludicrous things. So we're seeing incentives built into the enforcement process that encourage enforcement to act like Sheriff of Nottingham. Now the reason I tell you all of this is what sometimes happens in this situation is we will see incredible enforcement against people who thought it could never happen to them. I mean, you all know the story that it happened to me, and I'm not saying that because it happened to me, but rather because I see more and more instances of people who need to know that when you have this much enforcement bureaucracy and this much political pressure to enforce and this much financial incentive for them to enforce, that the odds that we could all have to deal with such things are rise. And it's one of the reasons I really emphasize to people, you want to, it's another reason you want to know your neighbors, you want to know the civic organizations and small businesses in your community that are run by the good guys. The more you can be intertwined and part of a community and people can know you and know that you support them personally and financially, the more protected you are. The more degrees of separation there are between you and the Sheriff of Nottingham. It's funny, I've had a spate of people this week, including people with extraordinary, what I would consider to be extraordinary wealth, tell me that because of the drops in the stock market and other things, they can't afford to keep giving. And what I will tell you is you can't not afford to keep giving because, you know, I'm a tither, and I try to take at least 10% of my income, or if not time or other things, and keep on giving. And I will tell you, you know, I've been very wealthy, and I've also been destitute, and I never stop giving on the way down to destitute and the way back up. And I've found that it's an investment in community, it's an investment in your network, and everything you put out comes back. And this is a time when you need to build network and community. So, you know, when you work with your budget and you think about your finances, really do think about giving. I was just laughing as I was preparing this because I remember this is my most outrageous giving story. I was furious about something that was going on, you know, some evil Federal Reserve Act, and a request came in from Ron Paul for a donation, and I literally didn't have a dime. I didn't have a dime in my checking account. I didn't have a dime in my pocket, and in the mail came a ridiculous offer for a ridiculous credit card from a ridiculous bank. And so I agreed to take the credit card and sent Ron Paul a donation on the credit card. I thought that was a great way of moving money from the New York Fed banks over to Ron Paul. Anyway, so that's it for money and markets. Let them eat cake. It's worth taking a look at the blog post about is your pie legal? Because I think it's good to think about how you can make sure to protect yourself from this kind of increased enforcement for process. Now's the time to have your paperwork straight and to be impeccable in your compliance. Okay, Ask Catherine. We had an excellent question that I really wanted to address with you. It was let me see if I can get the exact words. Somebody said, why won't the elites let us work? And what we're watching in America, the most disturbing trend, is extraordinary increases in unemployment and underemployment. And, of course, how can you kickstart an economy if no one has any jobs? And how can real estate have any value if the people living in it don't have jobs? And how can corporations that are supposed to make their money providing products and services to people make any money if the people who traditionally buy the products and services don't have any money? So, I mean, that's the big solvency problem in the economy. Why won't the elites let us work? I've done a series of stories that really dig in and get into some of the issues. One is the story of Edgewood Technology Services, which is a story I wrote in 1998, which is you can link to from the homepage. Another is the Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, which you can also link to from the homepage. And finally, another one that you can pick up on a search on the web, Piracy on the Delaware. And what it goes through is some of the different reasons for the extraordinary switch of jobs, particularly high-end jobs in manufacturing abroad. One is the fact that technology makes it easier to move work abroad, and in countries like India and Asia and Latin America, you have tremendously skilled, intelligent, younger workforces that very much want this work and are willing to do extraordinary things and be very productive doing it. That's number one. The second is it's much easier to affect control if you can outsource a lot of work, particularly work that makes the worker smart. So, for example, anything having to do with financial data, it's much easier if you can get people in other countries to do it. The story I tell in the story of Edgewood Technology Services is building software tools and database that would help people see government money on a place-based basis. Well, if you can map out and see how all the government money works in your neighborhood, that makes you very smart, and it makes it much harder to suppress the knowledge you need to suppress if you're going to maintain control. So suppression of knowledge is a big one, and if you look at a lot of outsourcing patterns, you know, ever wonder when you call phone information, you get a prison or somebody 2,000 miles away? A lot of that is to get the knowledge sort of mixed up. Another is when you want to re-engineer the governance structure in a country, sort of pulling the legs out from under the middle class makes it much easier to do that. And I think that's one of the things that's happening in America. Another motivation is it may not be economic. A lot of switching things and outsourcing things is nowhere near as economic as what people say. But when you do it, you can leave you can leave 2,000 people in America who now have a reduced income, usually with government subsidy. And when you move the work, you move it to a company that makes you more money on the bottom line because you happen to own the stock. So we see a lot of manipulation of jobs that are really switching who gets the pickup on their stock. It's really a stock play. And it allows you to centralize control and centralize control into the hands of you and your pals, depending on which syndicate is sort of doing this. Finally, there's a lot of new technology. We see, you know, very high-tech plants in Latin America that literally can do with a few computer operators what, you know, 20 years ago was done with 2,000 people. So part of it is new technology as well. And finally, the reality is there are tremendous population pressures on planet Earth, and there are a lot of people. And there's no doubt that, you know, within the top 1%, there's a feeling that we could do less with less people. And so moving things around like this and building more centralized control, particularly in a way that makes the top 1% money, is sort of a way to shift the money up and shift the control up in a way that begins to help you deal with the excess population. And the reality is if you look at any of the articles I've written about the pincer movement of drugs and mortgage fraud moving into a community, basically what you're seeing is depopulation And gentrification is a more profitable way of manipulating that neighborhood than helping the people there succeed. It's an ugly picture, but that's what it is. So if you're interested in sort of those dynamics, I would encourage you to read those different articles. It is important to know that we're dealing with leadership that does not necessarily have our best interests at heart and will not necessarily respect our property and has at their disposal fantastic ways and very subtle ways of manipulating us, our time, and our money. So with that, let me just check. Dimitri, are you with us? We seem to have lost Dimitri. Anais?
I was not able to reach him.
Huh. Okay, well, that's too bad, but what I would love to do is walk through Reinventing Collapse with you, because I think it's, hopefully he'll join us. But I think it's an excellent, the reason I wanted to do this with you today is if you look at the Russian example, there are a couple of examples I've lived through or worked with people who've lived through or spent a lot of time studying. One is Russia, one is Eastern Europe, and one is Argentina and some other countries in Latin America. And let's go through Russia. The Soviet Union broke apart in the early 90s, and one of the things that happened was, there's several similarities between the Soviet Union and the United States. You had growing trade deficits. You had tremendous military budgets. You had more and more centralized control. And as a result, you had, increased lack of productivity. And finally, you had an effort to keep up with sort of Star Wars spending by the United States, as well as the Afghanistan campaign. And my guess is, and I can't prove this, you also had a certain amount of financial manipulation from the West. As a result, the Soviet Union broke apart. And what you saw started in 1991. You saw AID and a series of both international and U.S. development agencies move in with Harvard University as the advisor, and with an effort to bring Western-style markets and sort of capitalism, that was sort of the guise, and to privatize the government. And so there was an effort to privatize all sorts of industries that had been owned or managed by the state before then. And it's a little bit like the shock treatment that you read about when you read Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine. And what you see is just very shocking change happening to an economy. One of the things that happens is you go to bed one day and you have pension funds and you have a job and you have money in the bank. And you wake up the next morning, and your currency has collapsed, and so the money in bank is worthless. You go to work, and that translates into, within 1 to 3 months, the job collapsing. And then, within some period of time, the pension fund may get raided or collapsed as well. And so somebody who thinks they're remarkably hardworking, conscientious, have saved, et cetera, wakes up and finds that they've been wiped out. And I remember when the money started to go missing in the United States, started leaving the federal government in 98 and 99, I remember being very frightened because it seemed to me, if you looked at how much money was being pulled out both legally and illegally out of the society, there was no way that all of the pension fund arrangements, whether state, local, or federal, or corporate, ultimately, my back-of-the-envelope estimate was there was no way all these promises we had made to ourselves, whether Social Security, pension funds, retirement savings, could be good. And I remember my extraordinary efforts to try and warn people of what was happening. And one of the things that was became very clear is that it was inconceivable to most Americans that any of this extraordinary financial fraud could in any way impair the fundamental integrity of the system. They literally could not believe that $4 trillion missing from the federal government or pump and dump of the telecom and internet stocks and the extraordinary growth of really systemic financial fraud in any way would threaten, you know, their private or public pension fund. And it seemed to me that, there was a great danger, particularly because I was very focused on the on what was happening abroad and that this was, in fact, what was happening in the Soviet Union. I'll never forget in the, if you look at the gross numbers, in 2000, you had poverty in the former Soviet Union grow from 14 million people to something like, I think it was 25 million in just a decade. And I read, I was reading a book about the sort of deterioration, and there was a quote from a lawyer who was living in a home with no electricity and growing her own food. And she said, to describe the process, we're being demodernized. And so you had an entire professional class that had just been left to, themselves. And what happened was you got an extraordinary rise of organized crime, including operations by the Americans that pulled extraordinary money out of Russia and moved it back here. One of the things that helped boom our stock market from about 94 to 98 was money that we were pulling out of Russia, and then finally it collapsed. And part of that money was the IMF was putting money in, and then the money would be laundered back into the United States. And so it's funny, one of the reasons I always, when I hear Dmitry speak, I'm struck, because sometimes you can hear the frustration in his voice. I've always, one of the things that's very much concerned me is if you look at the extraordinary damage that we did to that society, and how much money was pulled out and came back into the United States, really the absence of knowledge or concern with the pain caused to the Russian people has always made me wonder sort of, you know, what is our karma in all of this? And in the collapse cycle that we as Americans, or certainly our financial community and our professional class, have been sort of guilty of doing around the world. And we all have been making, many of us have been making money on it in our 401ks, et cetera. You know, what is going to be the karma of that for us as people? Now, one of the things, if you read Reinventing Collapse, and I really recommend you doing so, what Dmitry does, he's an engineer by training, and I think one of the things I find the most useful about his book is he goes through the different areas, housing, transportation, employment, families, money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and talks about what happened in Russia and then what it means to us. And I want to just touch on a couple of areas which I think are very important. One is food. If you look at the headlines over the last literally 30 days, because I live in a farming community, so I tend to really pay attention and hear a lot about food headlines. What we're seeing, for example, is all sorts of pressures and stress on farming and the agricultural community. For example, the Pennsylvania Dairy Association reported that they're getting, their farmers are getting significantly per gallon the price they're getting per gallon of milk is significantly below what it costs to make it, and they expect a fair amount of the dairy producers to go out of business. We're seeing reports like that around the country. I got a similar report from Alaska the other day on a dairy farm there. So tremendous pressure on farmers. The stories of droughts and the impact of weather changes and unusual weather patterns, tremendous stress. At the same time, the credit financing for farming, particularly small farmers, we're getting more and more reports of that drying up. And so the ability of farmers as an economic matter to basically plant and deliver a harvest this year appears to be under significant stress. Now, when you add to that the greater difficulties financially of shipping from far away, because you know how far away our food comes from, we're watching more and more stress on the food system. Add to that the unemployment and the financial problems, and we're seeing more and more predictions this summer of serious issues with food shortages, both in the U.S. and around the world. And so, you know, one of the most you've seen on the Soleri website for years now is, you know, my expression, who's your farmer, who's your banker, where's your money? And I keep saying to many of my friends, including friends who live in the city, you know, why don't you start buying your food from a local farmer? And they say, what are you talking about? You know, how inconvenient. I'll just run down to Whole Foods. Well, if you listen to Dimitri talk about the problems with food in America, one of the things he points out is the extent to which the state-sponsored agriculture in Russia was very inefficient, and as a result, many people had gardens and knew how to garden. And so when collapse came, there was far more broad-based skills in knowing how to garden. Now, one of the things that's interesting, what I'm seeing is just many, many more people interested in gardening and spontaneous discussions of getting together and finding ways of connecting to local farmers. You're seeing farmers' markets grow up, all very positive developments. But one of the things when you contemplate collapse is it really underscores the importance of finding very high-quality food. It was not in Dimitri's article, but another article I posted in our disaster preparedness blog post that I did a couple months ago. You can find it on a search on the blog. Was an article by another person who was in Russia and lived through the collapse. And what he said was the people who had high-quality vitamins really were in much better shape than the people who didn't. And I'll never forget the day. It was about 6 months ago. I knew I'd really crossed the Rubicon because I turned on the computer one night and there was just some horrible, dire headline. I forget what it was. And I thought, you know, I better just drive into town and get some more cash out and put it in the safe. And I thought, no, the cash went to me any good. I think I'll order a stockpile of very high-quality vitamins. And I do. I have a 2-year supply of what I consider to be the highest quality multiple vitamin, inspired by the Russian example. Another thing Dimitri talks a lot about is money. What happens if the currency collapses? And the importance of having something that will function as money that is liquid. And interestingly enough, the story he tells is going to Russia and having plenty of rubles, but not being able to find anybody who was particularly excited about taking them. What he discovered was that vodka made a much better currency than rubles, or I think probably at that time even precious metals. And so it's interesting, inspired by his example, I now have a stockpile of liquor here. One of the things you've heard me say again and again, and it's a drum I'll beat again, is the value of having your money in tangible assets. And I always encourage people to stockpile any non-perishable that you're going to use. If you have the resources to make sure you have a one or two, your inventory of anything that you know you're really going to use. So I'm not suggesting you run out and buy things that you don't use every day and won't have real value. But if you look at either one, the dangers of inflation, or two, the dangers of problems in the supply chain in a deflation, you know, they're very real. And so I think that is a much better or much sounder investment, in fact, than having money in a money market or in a bank, even if there's no collapse. Another thing Dimitri talks a lot about is transportation. And all I can say is one of the things he emphasizes is the importance and the power of having a good bicycle, which I agree with, but I've always been a biker. Let me just run through the employment. He talks a lot about how hard it is to adapt to these kinds of changes. And I think that if you can get anything out of his work that's invaluable, he has an expression which he calls zero psychological damage. How can you adapt to a radical change in our economic circumstances or political circumstances and do it with zero psychological damage? Because I found that I've seen people who adapt very quickly and do so with a positive attitude and who end up doing very well in these kinds of circumstances, and people who don't. And one of the areas is around the area of employment, because you go from a world where you have a job and you feel security about where your income is coming from, and you wake up the next day and you can't get your status from your employment. There is no employment. And so people who, I went from a situation in the 90s where I had extraordinary status to where I had extraordinary negative status. And I had to find a way to be cheerful and happy and build a great life and not worry about the loss of my status. And what I've discovered is the faster that you can make that change, the more successful you will be in building what is a switch really from having a job to being an entrepreneur, and being an entrepreneur where some of the things you're doing for barter, some of the things you're just doing to be useful, and over time some of the things you do because it does bring in a kind of income, whether it gets paid in vodka or precious metals or money. And so we have to find a way to say it is what it is and let's move forward. And he really focuses on the difference between people who can make the positive adaptation and people who kind of get stuck about and grumping about the system, or people who wait for someone to come and help. Because it's very hard when you believe you have a position, you believe you're part of something, you believe you have a status, to realize the position's gone, there is no status, it's a new game, and in fact there are people in that game who are dangerous and will take everything you have, and you need to organize to protect yourself against them. Another very important area is crime. And in Russia, what you saw was the people who had worked as the police, the people who had worked in the military, the people who had worked in the intelligence agencies started hiring themselves out as private armies. And in fact, people who did well were the people who had that kind of intelligence and enforcement capability. And if you didn't have that, if anything, you were a target. And reading the Russian example is a little bit scary. In this vein, I do think America is different than Russia. And I was going to ask Dimitri sort of about the role of secret societies, because so much of America since the Revolutionary War has really been run, you know, every town and every county is sort of bottom-up networked by the secret societies. And that's a government that is much more enduring than the official U.S. government. And it's hard for me to see that network really implode, particularly because they have so much money buried into the foundations, the universities, and held offshore. And so I have a hard time seeing that implode. And some of their good qualities is they're relatively good about keeping sort of basic operations and basic law of the people who will, you know, be respectful of them going. But I do think that there's that it is very important to think about that we talked last week about random crime versus covert crime, or the week before. But I do think it is very important to think about how to organize to deal with random crime and to be in communication with local law enforcement and your neighbors about it, because there's no doubt when you have economic problems of this sort, you have more random crime and you have more economic crime, and it's real and it needs to be dealt with, and a lot of us have been protected from it. One of the things you realize when you read Dimitri's comparisons of Russia versus America, we are just an incredibly spoiled society. One of the reasons I moved to Hickory Valley, Tennessee, is having spent time here, and I live next to family who've been farmers for many generations and never left the rural areas. I live in a community where there's extraordinary, you know, there's extraordinary support still for each other. I tell the story when I first got here I had a bicycle accident, and it was about 2000, and I'd been a member for about a year of the Hickory Valley Women's Club, and I had to stay in bed. I had a concussion. I had to stay in bed for about a week, and every morning, lunch, and dinner, there was a knock on the door, and it was another member of the Hickory Valley Women's Club with a hot plate meal for me. And that went on for a week, and it took my breath away. It was, you know, you could no more, living in New York and Washington and growing up in Philadelphia, you could no more imagine that happening to you after the 50s in America. And so there's still a lot of sort of community spirit and community networking here. When, I'll never forget driving, I was sometime around 2001, I was driving up the New Jersey Turnpike, and I stopped to get gas, and there was a very fancy SUV with two fancy mountain bikes and a very attractive young couple in it, in a very bad mood. I have no idea what happened with them, but when I didn't get my gas fast enough, the guy flipped and started screaming at me, and I thought, you know, how in the world, if we really do get a Russia kind of situation here, and, you know, how in the world are they possibly going to cope? And that's one of the things that worries me the most. I went back to read stories of the Depression and how people adjusted to a real economic recession, and who did well and who didn't. And again, one of the things you discover is there's much more community networking, much more community spirit, and much more concrete skills. And I think one of the issues we all have to grapple with is, you know, where are the pockets of people who know how to deal with real trouble? And one of the things you might think about if you're in the process of networking with your neighbors is how can you start to map out who are the people in your community who have the requisite skills you need to be much more locally self-sufficient and locally resilient. Which brings me to the next area, medicine, which is a tricky one, because in the United States we have an extraordinary medical complex. It's been the source of great growth of jobs and economic activities. It's heavily government subsidized. If for any reason we should get an unmanaged process, we could just see extraordinary change in terms of people's current dependency on very expensive and very sort of Western medicine, and we could see a pretty radical shift. If you look at the number of Americans right now who are dependent on pharmaceuticals, it's just extraordinary numbers, including mood-altering drugs. So if you look at Ritalin or various tranquilizers, it's really extraordinary. And I literally have trouble imagining what would happen if we should ever be in a situation where we woke up, and everybody had to cold turkey from all their different drugs. So this is an area where the way we've been doing healthcare has been phenomenally expensive and is growing in expense. On one hand, you have more and more people being pushed out of the system. I was somebody who went through the process of getting pushed out of the system, and as a result, oddly enough, I'm much healthier. And fewer and fewer enjoying the benefits of just much more extraordinary medicine. And so one of the things to contemplate is who in your community, where are the nurse practitioners, where are the alternative health practitioners, who is it that knows about health and can help you in your community start to deal with a situation where you have to have much more local resiliency in the area of health. I wanted to mention one thing on housing, because one of the things that Dmitry mentions is in the Soviet Union, you had many more people owning their housing stock or having public housing stock, and not the kind of mortgage and indebtedness that we have here. And one of the things he mentioned was the importance of squatting, of just going in and moving and, you know, just taking empty houses and going in and moving and living in them. And interestingly enough, and I put it up on the blog last week, there was a report in the New York Times about people in Florida just doing that, in Miami, just so not-for-profit groups, and for a cost to themselves of $200, what they've been doing is taking families and moving them into homes that are empty, you know, foreclosed homes, because there are tons of them sitting around. Just an extraordinary example. Let me just mention before I leave the different areas, energy, because energy is really one of the big question marks. There's great debate about how much energy is available, what technology will be available, what will the cost of energy be. One of Dmitry's theories is that the Soviet Union was energy rich, which is the case, and the United States has peaked in its energy in 1970 and is much more dependent on military action around the world to get cheap energy. And, there are others who debate that thesis. If you're interested in sort of the energy transition issues, there's a very good DVD put out by Community Solutions called How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. And it literally walks you through a society that in 1989, when the Soviet Union fell, was getting a fair amount of oil and other energy and other things from the Soviet Union, and literally overnight has its energy availability cut dramatically and has to completely reinvent how it does agriculture and transportation and a whole bunch of other things. And it's a very interesting story about how they adapted. And you almost get the feeling on the other side of it is that everybody was skinnier, healthier, and there was more community there. So it's sort of an interesting thing to watch. I'm not going to go through all the other areas just because of time, but I did want to talk about the issue that we started debating on the blog, collapse versus what I call slow burn. As you know, if you follow my writing or the Soleri reports, one of the things I literally agonize about morning, noon, and night is will the dollar fall? If it falls, by how fast? And I have a scenario that I talk a lot about the slow burn, which in essence is a scenario in which the dollar and the people who manage the dollar can be held up ad infinitum by a pretty amazing combination of military and surveillance and enforcement force. And I've encouraged you all to see the movie Syriana and some of these other movies that really show how that sort of the global taxation system works. I've said before that I think in theory we can keep the dollar up forever if that group wants to, because we have the force in place, the weaponry to do it. And it's a pretty dire scenario, because in fact, if you look at what it takes to finance the force and to finance the system, it requires a slow-moving collapse of pretty much everybody else. And so you literally have a group of insiders and the people who do their bidding, let's call that 20%, and then slowly what you see is the wealth and the health of the other 80% slowly liquidated. So I would say, you know, one of the big questions I have with Dimitri is, you know, could collapse happen here? Well, I would say that collapse is happening here, but it's happening to a small percentage of the population at any given time, and it's all as though we're slowly, you know, working our way through the population. If you go back to the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and the university, I use the University of Pennsylvania, which is my alma mater, and I grew up there. My father, brother, and grandfather all taught at the University of Pennsylvania, and so I'm familiar with it. So I don't mean to pick on it. It's just that I'm familiar. You know, as the university got richer and richer and richer, the minority communities around it got poorer and poorer and poorer as a result of mortgage fraud and narcotics trafficking. And if you look at all the flows of how that money worked its way through the system, those two things are connected. And so we've been collapsing communities and populations for decades now. I mean, if you look at the what Iran-Contra did to a place like Mena, Arkansas, or, you know, communities throughout this country with extraordinary real estate and mortgage fraud and other sort of, and including narcotics trafficking, which has been a very big one. But we've seen the implosion of lots and lots of communities and lots of places. It's just, you know, not everybody's been affected at the same time. The interesting example of the Russian collapse was, you know, it sort of happened at a big bang. But as the slow burn is happening here, you know, collapse is something that's slowly winding its way to many, many people's doors. And I think that's why one of the reasons I wanted you to read Dimitri's work and hear from him, and other people will have other people on with examples of these kinds of things happening, is the reason you want to build local resiliency is not necessarily because what happened in Russia will happen here. It's because even if it doesn't happen here, what we want to learn is we want to learn how not to be dependent on a system that we can't trust. Because if you look at the economics, I will tell you that even if we don't have a collapse, and even if you don't need to grow your own food, the every indication that the quality of the food that we can buy in the store is deteriorating, and the control and games that will apply to it are deteriorating, and there is very important reasons why you want to know where your food comes from and who grew it and what's in it. And so the whole point of building local resiliency and getting to know your neighbors is we're in a long-term process where the centralized systems are either more and more economically not efficient, more and more dependent on the politics of force, more and more sort of not grounded and not logical. And so what's going to happen is that to accomplish what we need and to really be happy and healthy, we're going to have to really go with the dynamics of decentralization. And that means doing things very differently. if you go back, one of the things I encourage all of you to do is get a hold of your elders, because many of the sort of older generation grew up at a time when people really knew how things worked in their neighborhood. So they knew how the police worked. They knew how the utilities worked. They knew how the water worked. They knew how the transportation worked. They knew how the waste removal worked up. I used to think, because of all the database work I was doing and the work I'd done on housing and real estate, that I understood places. And it wasn't until I moved to a rural area and where everything was small enough in scale that I could really start to understand how everything in a community works in terms of operations. We're going to do some audio seminars this summer on mapping your local ecosystems, but a lot of mapping your local ecosystems is just understanding how all the operations work and who the people are that work them, and finding ways of interacting with them which are just more energizing for you. So your elders, people who are much older, either lived in a world where more people were generalists, or they had this, their scale was more manageable. Now, you know, for example, when I worked on Wall Street, I went to work early in the morning, I stayed late at night, I was the world's leading expert in this tiny thing, and I came home and I had no idea where anything came from or how the operations worked. I was completely place blind. I hardly knew my neighbors. It was about the opposite, and I think that's happened to a lot of us. And what some of us are grappling with is, now as this push is coming to decentralize, how do we start to learn, and how do we do it in a way which is energizing and pleasurable for us? Anyway, so that's sort of my walkthrough. I posted up on the blog two articles by Dimitri, which I recommend. One is Closing the Collapse Gap, which is a presentation. In fact, I saw him make it at a Peak Oil conference that walks, it's a PowerPoint, it walks through what happened in Russia and compares that to the United States, and sort of gives, sort of his take on why he thinks collapse, which he is convinced will happen in America, could be worse for America. And then the second one is very useful. It's called Social Collapse Best Practices, and it's really about how to adjust to this kind of situation. One of the things I was going to mention before was when I just spoke in Cleveland and had a very interesting circumstance, because a third to a half of the audience was African American. And the African American community, particularly the African American Christian community, has developed extraordinary knowledge and technology about how to deal with collapse. I mean, their neighborhoods have lived through significant and very real collapse in the middle of what was supposed to be sort of bubble prosperity. And they know an awful lot about how to deal with it effectively, and particularly how to get over the loss of status, the loss of prestige, and how to have fun and deal with terribly unfair circumstances and sort of let them eat cake attitude from the Wall Street Washington crowd. So I would really encourage you, if there are African American communities in your area, particularly the great churches, there's a lot they know about collapse, that are just wonderful pockets of knowledge within our society. And there are also lots of immigrants who've come, like Dimitri, from other countries who've dealt with it. So we have lots of pockets of people who know how to deal with these kinds of circumstances. I have a wonderful aunt and uncle who have several friends who, and my parents did as well, who lived through World War I and World War II, and really, the ones who lived through World War II and the Nazis are still alive, and there's a lot they can teach us about how to deal with it. Okay, so with that, I encourage you to read the articles and think about what it means in terms of the actions you can take to sort of build local resiliency for yourself. Next week, we're going to have If you think Dmitry Orlov can be scary in terms of his belief that collapse can happen in America, wait till you hear Cliff High. Cliff High is a former Microsoft software developer. He became very interested in how to use software to read and aggregate large amounts of information on the Internet that would help understand sort of what was going on. And he started something called the Half-Past Human Project. It's literally a future forecasting service. What he does is he employs a technique which he calls radical linguistics, and he has another name for it, where I guess it's asymmetric language trend analysis, where he tries to read fantastic amounts of communication and information postings on the Internet and interpret what they are saying about what people think is going to happen. And he's literally trying to read what is happening physically on the planet, what is happening in the financial markets, what is happening in geopolitics. And I started to read, it's a subscriber service, I started to read Cliff's reports because a number of subscribers and members of our network became very intrigued with it, encouraged me to do so. And I have a whole bunch of thoughts about it. I don't want to prejudice you with them. I want you to get a chance to listen to Cliff. But I found, one of the things I found very, very valuable about his material is it was very integrating. For many years now, I've gone back and forth between many different worlds. So people who are in the financial markets and committed to equity investment, or in the commodities market and very interested in precious metals, or people who think the world's going to collapse and are, you know, practicing local resiliency and building intentional communities, or different kind of activist groups. And sometimes I feel like I have a bungee rope in my head because all the different groups are interested in some things but not all things and don't want to hear about this other group. And so when you read Cliff's reports, they're very integrating. They kind of integrate everything and look at everything in a very powerful way. And I think that integration is very good and very healthy. And I certainly find them interesting. But if you really want to be inspired to build local resiliency, read some of Cliff's reports because they will literally scare you to action. Our first report in May, Cliff will be next week, April 23rd. Our first report in May is going to be Derivatives 101. And here's my subtitle because I could just hear you all asking, what's Derivatives 101? Here's my subtitle, Useful Knowledge in Plain English About Credit Default Swaps, Interest Rate Swaps, Futures and Other Complex Financial Instruments That Make the Financial System Ungovernable and the Financial News Incomprehensible. So my goal with that is as you read the financial news, clearly the bailouts, number one use is derivatives and the manipulation and management in the market, which has grown tremendously in the last decade, is coming from derivatives. And if you look at that marvelous upside-down chart I put up about a week ago, you know, derivatives are basically ruling the planet. And so if we're gonna make sense of the news, or we're just going to deal with life as it's happening, I think it is important to have a basic understanding of what derivatives are and how they're being used. I'll tell you a funny story. I used to be on the board of Sallie Mae, which is the big private company that securitizes student loans. And it was about 1994. And sitting on the board was the vice chairman of J.P. Morgan, the vice chairman of one of the big banks in Chicago, First Chicago, and, you know, sort of seven big, you know, very smart, talented senior guys at the big banks. And we gave the chief financial officer's office gave a presentation on derivatives. And so I just started asking really basic questions. And what I realized was, I don't think any one of those guys understood what derivatives were, and yet they were all governing organizations that had exploding derivatives, and I thought, this is really scary. So so hopefully I can bring it down to some plain English and we can start to get our arms around derivatives, and I hope it will just help make you feel powerful when you're reading the financial news and dealing with the financial hitmen and women in your lives, at least the ones you haven't gotten out of your lives. Hopefully you're getting them all out. The movie on May the 7th, we're not going to have a movie next week. The movie on May the 7th is going to be a very British coup, which was originally a TV series. I know you can get it on Netflix. It's about a Labour prime minister who's committed to disarmament, and it's very useful in understanding many of the obstacles that face a politician or a leader who's trying to bring about real change. And I think it's a very interesting. It's also very charming. It's very fun to watch. So with that, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.